Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Igor Stravinsky once remarked, "Music is the sound wave of the soul." Like spirituality, music is ineffable, with the power to inspire and soothe, to animate and comfort, to unite and uplift. The writer Kurt Vonnegut said, with his characteristic wry irreverence, quote, "If I should ever die, God forbid, let this be my epitaph. The only proof he needed for the existence of God was music." Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Please subscribe to our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. I'm pleased to welcome Asaf Schellig to the show today to talk about his recent book, Theological Stains, Art, Music, and the Zionist Project. Asaf Schellig is a senior lecturer of musicology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who specializes in 20th century Jewish and Israeli art music. His earlier book, Jewish Contiguities and the Soundtrack of Israeli History, was published by Oxford University Press in 2014. Asaf Schellig, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Renee. Thank you for having me. And thank you for reading Theological Stains.
I'd like to begin the interviews by asking about someone or something that had a powerful impact on your own intellectual development.
Good question. One of my piano teachers, before I started going to music academies and trained myself as a concert pianist, in addition to an aspiring musicologist, was a pianist who encouraged me to read beyond the notes. His name is Zacharia Plavin. He's an Israeli pianist of Latvian birth. And if he would play a sonata by Beethoven, he would send me to read Shakespeare. If he would play Liszt, he would send me to read Victor Hugo or Nietzsche. Or Lamartine, and so forth. So gradually I learned that there are so many concentric circles without which music means nothing. And that was the moment when the seed was planted to think about musicological lenses.
What are theological stains? Let's start by unpacking your title.
Okay. It seems provocative, and provocative is always good for intellectual circles, I think. And it might come off as something, I don't know, anti-Zionist, but that would be the easy way to interpret that. Stains, of course, is annoying in some sense, and especially when it's combined with theology. However, stained glass is the purest thing you can think of. So, and I wasn't aiming at something negative. I was just trying to say that there is an infrastructure here, a cultural, political, theological infrastructure of this thing we call Zionism. It animated the entire Zionist project from its grammar to its culture and eventually to its politics and territorial expansionism. So many people who deal with, many scholars who deal with political theologies always use this term in a very holistic manner. And when you look at culture, when you listen to music, read literature, modern Hebrew poetry, plays, even translations of Shakespeare or Nietzsche in Hebrew, then you realize the extent of this theological network and the way it permeated everything in this national territorial culture. But when it comes to culture, it's not holistic. We have residues and traces and stains. And stains for me are like echoes in sound. They leave lots of traces, lots of evidence, lots of networks to be traced, lots of associations. Bruno Latour once termed that a sociology, which means sociology of associations. So stains for me is like clues or traces or residues through which I can build those networks and trace agents and mediators, be they human or non-human, through which again I can reconstruct the discourse and series of meanings when I listen to music and then look at archival material. So we have theological, which is this theological infrastructure of Zionism on the one hand, and on the other hand we have stains because we are only left with fragments to deal with, and sometimes they're very intrusive. Sometimes they would be like a stain. They would be displaced. Sometimes it would be less conspicuous, and they would if you notice them, then you might end up discovering, unexplored territories and meaning.
Now, the last words of your title, the Zionist Project. The Zionist Project is the Jewish national project, and the relationship between art, music, and modern nationalism has been found in many, many countries, really quite a wide range in the late 19th and early 20th century. You find it in the United States, the Soviet Union, Denmark, countries whose nationalism is quite different from one another. Is there a common dynamic to the relationship between music and nationalism?
Well, there is. If you think about any society whose national project or sense of nationalism, national awareness, especially when you have when it moves towards statehood, then there are some earmarks and characteristics that are associated with nationalism. We're a bit different because we had to relocate in order to materialize our national project. And so when Jews wanted to be part of the Zionist project, they had to relocate from wherever they lived, Europe, Asia, Africa, America. And because they came from so many locations and had to grapple with the sense of nationalism, they had some previous models they were drawing on, very consciously, by the way. And when it comes to music, the entire repertoire of 19th century European art music and composers, especially from the peripheries, who were trying to display the peripheral masks, be it Czechoslovakia or Hungary, in certain cases, Italy and France. It was very powerful and a model for those who got their basic musical training in European academies and at European universities. So they came out with those templates and wanted to apply them to what was taking place in British Palestine at the time.
Why do you think that until fairly recently, musicology and sociology, both disciplines, have largely ignored the role of music in nation building and nationalism?
Because it's different. It's a different kind of language. It's a pre-symbolic language. It's unsurprising to see that when sociologists, for example, talk about popular music, they usually talk about the lyrics rather than the music itself. And to dig into, first of all, you have to know how to read music, and that's like knowing another language with its code and histories and so forth, idioms, registers. But then you need to look at a score and decipher its own histories. Again, idioms, textures, templates of various kinds that that are being employed in the text. So it's really uncommon for, I would say, sociologists or an historian to have the ability to deal with music. That's why, you know, we are like art historians. Musicologists are like art historians in many ways, only that we deal with the art history of the invisible. But this invisible is written in many formats. It could be the score itself, the manuscripts that lead to it, sketchbooks of various kind, but also primary sources in every language you can think of that are part of the network that eventually lead to this to the final product, to this music. So it was very easy for a sociologist or historian to talk about certain titles or certain buzzwords like Havana Gila or Hora dances in the Yeshuv, in the Jewish community of Palestine. But beyond that, to talk about musical earmarks and signifiers and the way they were distorted or paraphrased or tweaked in any kind, that requires a bit of specific knowledge in musical semiotics, say, or things like that.
When you're mentioning Havana Gila or those kind of folk music, brings up the issue of Israel's diverse ethnic society. How did it tell us about how that diversity enriched and created challenges for its serious composers?
Let's start with your last two words, serious composers. I just read this morning some reviews on Gershwin's music in the 30s and 40s, and his music was perceived as some sort of a miscegenation, as a mixed racial formula of some sort, where he was doing something a bit Negroid, that's I'm quoting, of course, and Jewish, and it was not really serious. So this whole height aspect or hierarchy is a bit of a problem, because when you start with serious music, you think that, okay, we are at the top of a we are at a high rung, and we're not going to bow down and collect some interesting ethnographic imports from the various non-European communities that would enrich our culture. It was like that. I mean, I'm not trying to correct you. I'm trying to say that this is one of the major problems, that we had, by and large, an Eastern European cultural elite that that came up with this ideal model of the new Jew, the Hebrew, and this mold was tailored according to the way this Eastern European cultural and political elite understood that by Western paradigms, and they wanted everyone to fit into that, regardless of their background. So on the one hand, if we think about the early 20th century and the ethnographic fieldwork of Abraham Zvi Edelson, the Jewish music scholar, he has written a 10-volume thesaurus of the various different Jewish communities living back then in Ottoman Palestine. And the collection itself is marvelous, and the research is an eye-opening. And you wouldn't, we wouldn't have so much knowledge about this period and about the way oral Jewish music traditions had evolved. But then, when Westernness becomes the criteria for writing music with art music composers, with those who graduated in music academies and earned their bachelor's or graduate degrees and started writing sonatas and symphonies and maybe even operas. For them, this was very foreign. And the only model they knew is the way European composers, mainly from the peripheries of Europe, domesticated native or folk or liturgical music because they wanted to fit it to those Eurocentric Western paradigms. And so ethnographically speaking, the scene was extremely rich. What enters composers' canvases is at first is very limited because they wanted to be part of the discourse and they wanted to be relevant domestically. So let's take a simple, let's say, Yemenite tune that was available already in the late 19th century and surely in the early 20th century. Now, this entire scene of art music emerges and undergoes institutionalization in the 30s when we have a critical mass of composers, musicians, musicologists, and audiences coming in highly unprecedented, highly unusual and unprecedented numbers from Central and Western Europe, of course, following the rise of Nazism. And when they start writing, they are the scene, the various Jewish communities are enormously rich, but most of them are foreign to these composers, many of which didn't even know Hebrew. The majority of which were secular bourgeois Jews who knew very little about Jewish liturgy. So it was almost obvious that they would treat this music as something that was almost an ornament, an external ornament in their own music without changing the parameters and the paradigms and the idioms through which they expressed themselves or through which they learned how to express themselves. So at first, in the 30s and 40s, we get many compositions that sound like they're from the 19th century. They're very conservative, very traditional in the European sense, almost out of sync with what was happening in the interwar period in Europe itself, because they were familiar with this model through the concert hall and through their own education, and wanted to duplicate that. And so we might hear folk songs and references to liturgical music and various citations of, let's say, Yemenite Jewish tune or Bukharian dance, but it was tamed to fit to the bigger Western mold that through which it was projected. And it came with a price.
And yet, in those very traditional 18th, 19th, and earlier European music, Western classical or art music, the religious themes, biblical themes, are quite prominent. So making the transition to the theological stains would have seemed quite natural to those composers.
Yes, thematically speaking, it was easier for them to set prophetic texts from Isaiah or Ezekiel to music because they felt more comfortably in doing something that had international validity, or at least European validity, and especially domestic validity, because if a composer like Paul Ben-Chaim, who arrived in British Palestine from Munich in 1933, set Ezekiel's vision of the dry bones. This was, of course, an allegory for the revival of Israel, not biblical Israel, but modern Israel. And it was part and parcel of actualization of biblical texts in Palestine and later in Israel. And the piece I'm talking about is The Vision of a Prophet, a cantata for orchestra and tenor and a choir from 1958. This was really a common denominator that made it easy for them to write music. And I don't know if to identify with Zionism, because very few composers actually were Zionists. They came to Palestine, or they emigrated to Palestine because, for lack of a better option, actually, because very few could get to the U.S. In those years. Only composers with international reputation, like Arnold Schoenberg, for example. But for them, it was very easy. And unsurprisingly, if you read their letters, most of them perceived their emigration as temporary. They were hoping to go back to Europe. So this was like when they set biblical text to music, they knew that they are doing something that would have validity outside of Israel. It would serve a national function within the country. And it was a compromise they negotiated with Zionism, with which they never really identified.
Interesting. One of many of life's ironies. Recent decades have seen the renewed interest among secular Israelis in reclaiming their ancient heritage by studying biblical and Talmudic texts. At the same time, there's also been a resurgence of the music of poetry and prayer, the piyutim, that had been traditional among Mizrahi Jews, those who were expelled or fled from Arab and North African countries. How are these movements reflected in Israel's art music?
Whatever happens in the 90s and has been happening in more popular circles, people who study piyutim or maybe even Arab music, because you cannot really differentiate the Arab from the Jew if you want to study Syrian Jewish psalmody, for example. I recall Rabbi Ovadia Yosef once said that he reinterpreted the famous verse from Psalm 137. It says, by the streams of Babylon and so forth, but it says, "Al aravim betocha talinu kinorotenu," which usually meant that we hung our violins on aravim, means a certain tree, right? But then he says, no, al aravim means Arabs. We hung our culture, we put it amidst Arab culture. It was a beautiful interpretation, because you realize that the space or the way music disseminates is regardless of ethnic origins, political borders, and any predisposition we might have in mind in order to separate communities. So I was telling you earlier that the paradigms were very Eurocentric when people tried to project Zionist symbols in music. But concomitantly with that, there were composers who were drawn to this music and realized that there was a certain clash in domesticating or taming these musics when they get to a symphonic or a symphonic format or any genre that might misrepresent those musics. And so it started really early, already in the 50s, and I'm sure there are some precedents in the 40s, but already in the 50s we see dozens of examples wherein composers are either transcribing or taking transcriptions of Jewish musical traditions, non-European Jewish musical traditions, I should say, and trying to listen or to work with their properties. That is, they're trying to work with their melodic properties, harmonic properties, textural properties, and they sought ways to somehow have those properties expressed in the music without objectifying this so-called Oriental object with this so-called oriental import. And that was the beginning of this mutual change when European templates were suddenly bent. And there was a serious semiotic negotiation between the ethnographic import and what was supposed to contain it. And once those two sides of the equation starting to change, music had become less extrovert in the way it signified otherness or nationalism or Jews, for that matter. It became less national because, if you end up a symphonic movement with a hora, the mere rhythmic signifiers of a hora were something every listener in Palestine or Israel could easily decipher and decode. Whereas if you embed the texture of Yemenite Jewish music, this is something that is like a code for is an undecipherable code for many listeners, but for the composer, it's something he can is something that for him would be a true synthesis of this location of his place in this society, where he starts to listen to something that would enter his canvas only on the condition that the paradigms that would absorb it would be attentive enough to and flexible enough to rewrite this entire thing. And so it started very early in already in the 50s, when you'd think that this is the apex of Zionism. So finally, the third Jewish Commonwealth is founded, and we would hear nothing but formulations praising and duplicating the national allegory in its greatest success. But in reality, the fiscal situation was one of the most, I would say, unstable this country has ever experienced. There were waves of immigration coming from Europe and North Africa and the Near East, which the country couldn't handle. And one of the most surprising things, and I wasn't the first to write about that, is that the Hebrew itself, the choice of Hebrew among poets and authors, was not an ideological choice anymore, but the default. And so the greatest success of Hebrew culture, its greatest success was also its greatest failure. And there was a sense of disillusionment among many writers and poets and composers. And one of the symptoms for that, immediate symptoms, was when they turned to Jewish musical traditions and started to listen to its properties, refusing to cite it and situate it as something exotic, different, other, exilic, diasporic. They didn't want that anymore. They wanted to write music that would be attentive to the space they're now living in. That was too long an answer, wasn't it?
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
No, it was a great answer because it combined the wish for authenticity with the composer's need to express something that the audience is prepared to hear. And you also mentioned something practical about the economic hard times in the 1950s and fiscal issues. Let's take a little detour into pragmatics, because we can't ignore the role of funding for the arts, any arts. How is art music funded in Israel? And how is the balance between aesthetic and political financial considerations maintained?
Where do you want me to start from? The 50s or nowadays?
Start from nowadays and
okay.
Put in a few nuggets.
Nowadays, it's very, there's a lot of red tape involved in getting allocations. We haven't had a budget in this country for 2.5 years, so it's much more complicated if you want to speak about the here and now. But usually, it involves a lot of red tape. Orchestras usually play the European conservative canon, much more conservative than you would find, than any equivalent orchestra you'd find in Berlin or Oslo, Paris, and Amsterdam. Maybe it's this sense of... maybe this apologetics we carry with us because ever since the Israeli-Palestine Orchestra was founded, later to be renamed as the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, its founder Huberman wanted to have the West outside of the West. So there is a deep sense of apologetics involved in playing Beethoven and Mozart and Bach and Mendelssohn. Forget about the fact that he's Jewish, and Brahms and company. So now the music department at the Ministry of Culture would ask you to allocate certain a part of your repertoire to Israeli compositions written by Israeli composers, and that includes those who arrived here when Israel was not yet a state. And if you do that, you get your support is bigger. You get bonuses. So there is a whole system of giving you of benefiting you if you follow this this course. There are some ensembles that are dedicated to that dedicate their work to contemporary and modern music, and naturally they play more. Contemporary compositions by Israeli composers, they also get bonus allocations of various sorts, but it's more of, for them, it's more a matter of curating rather than working just to get the country's support. Without that, needless to say, it's like a museum for contemporary art. This whole business would simply collapse. What happened 50, 60, 70 years ago was very much different because of the same cultural and political Eastern European hegemony I was talking about earlier. For them, it was extremely natural to support orchestras, chamber ensembles, all kinds of operatic endeavors that were popping up here and there. And also to encourage art music, regardless of style, whether it was very modern or whether it was conservative, it didn't really matter. Composers were also teaching at various universities and music academies, so they also had their financial backup for writing. There were all kinds of awards encouraging writing, research to a certain extent. Supporting orchestras and ensembles, I said, it was a given. I recall now that in the 50s, there was in 1950 actually, very early in the game, one of the popular music composers who was also an ethnomusicologist, his name was Menashe Ravina, published this article called "Fear of Exoticism." In our music, and he actually feared he tried to look at the future and think what would happen if the people who are now appreciative of this Western culture we support would become a minority. What would happen to our conservatoires, to our orchestras? And because he was imagining. You know, lack of control of this model that held Westernness as the model to draw on. With between those two points in time, what is happening right now, is which, as I said, involves a lot of red tape. And what was happening back then, we have all kind of new ensembles and new projects competing for their hold of historical narratives, competing for this redefinition of Hebrew culture and later Jewish culture, or those who reverted completely from this notion of nationalism and are trying to write just contemporary music, just modern music without any national affiliations. And these competitions are always simultaneous, and they're really intriguing to follow, because right now an orchestra from Beersheva would say, you want us to play music by Israeli composers? Not a problem. We'll do Piyutim. We'll play Piyutim, rearranged for a small ensemble. And you can't tell us that's not Israeli, but the original intent was for you to play Israeli art music, which is less accessible, which is less popular. People are less exposed to that. So at the end of the day, the problem becomes a problem of curating, because we don't want to have Beethoven on the one end, and let's say Beethoven followed by Mendelssohn, and then an avant-garde composer by a 40-year-old Israeli guy who has nothing to do with Beethoven and Mendelssohn. And why is it a problem of curating? Because we have to create those corridors that would allow us to see certain pieces in time from the 18th to the 19th and the 20th and the 21st centuries, and understand that, first of all, they are part of this domestic history, but then they're also part of a bigger picture. They're part of modern Jewish culture to begin with, and part of the history of Western music. And Western music has changed dramatically over the last century, because so many non-Western elements infiltrated into those paradigms. The same way I was talking about in Israel in the 50s. And because they changed it so dramatically, we have so many stories to tell. And jumping from Beethoven to contemporary Israeli composers just leaves so many holes in the middle.
When you talk, and we talk about the influence of European music, just talking about Europe's influence on Israel, period, the trauma of the Holocaust in both Jewish and Israeli psyche and culture can't be overstated. How has the Holocaust itself influenced Israel's music?
Well, at first it didn't. Composers were very reluctant to talk about the Holocaust in any manner. So the earliest works we see are like private musical tombstones written in the memory of certain relatives, of the composer's relatives. Nothing too formal in, let's say, nothing too formal in the sense that you would hear a cantata or a symphony in the memory of Holocaust victims. We didn't get that until the 80s. So this is by itself a reflection of what was happening. This code of silence that was in power at least until the Eichmann trial. After that, we see again small scale works that are private and individual and may have been performed here and there, but its appearance, its weight at the concert hall was very different. So no one talked about it. In 1985, composer Noam Sharif wrote a piece called The Revival of the Dead. And it was very much a duplication of the classic Zionist narrative from destruction to from destruction to redemption. And destruction was, of course, the Holocaust, and redemption was political redemption in the form of the State of Israel. This was a piece that was pretty much out of sync with the current discourse, because by the time, what I want to say here is that it was a paradox that by the time composers were willing to publicize this national narrative leading from destruction to revival, the revival of the State of Israel, it was no longer relevant among neither poets nor authors who tried to dissociate the Holocaust from the way it was nationalized in Hebrew culture. And the most conspicuous evidence for that is David Grossman's novel, Sea Under Love, which came out in 1986.
Say a little more about that dissociation of, what was your sentence? To dissociate the experience from, I don't remember your exact words, but it's an interesting concept. I'd like you to expand on it.
Well, Zionism, by and large, what I want to say is that the disabled the way the Holocaust was nationalized in Hebrew culture. Why is that? Because Zionism Zionism managed Jewish history by creating this linear narrative leading from this short political sovereignty during biblical times to the destruction of the temple, Second Temple, to exile, to revival or redemption, which was political. So these were the basic ingredients of the national telos, of the national narrative, moving from sovereignty that was lost and now revived. And in the middle, we had destruction leading to exile, 18 centuries of exile, and now returning to political sovereignty, which is why the most important ingredient in Hebrew culture was Hebrew. It was the only relic to this biblical sovereignty. So with a narrative like that, which made sense, the Holocaust was another example, another manifestation of the insecurities and the dangers embedded in a life outside of a national territory. This was the biggest pogrom in history. And a proof for that Jews cannot live outside of their national territory. And Zionist rhetoric itself managed to shrink 18 centuries of exile into some sort of a nocturnal existence that was heading, again, the story is very teleological, I was heading toward redemption. But by doing so, while managing this kind of narrative, which was again duplicated almost without any doubts in Noam Sharif's work, The Revival of the Dead, by doing this, Zionist rhetoric ignored all those hundreds of thousands of symbioses that gave Jewish culture and Jewishness its own meaning. Because forget about those short periods in which we had and still do have sovereignty. The middle is so big to ignore. Can you ignore all those texts and music and rabbinical responsa, rabbinic literature, literature, philosophy, what have you? Can you ignore all that in favor of shrinking it so it would lead to the next stage, which is redemption? That was impossible to do. So what's so striking in David Grossman's Sea Under Love, which is probably one of his most brilliant novels, is that he consciously dissociated the way Zionism had nationalized the Holocaust, because it harnessed the Holocaust to be part of its own narrative, of its own telos of destruction leading to redemption or revival. And it took officials here, I think, almost 70 years. And I remember when Rivlin said on the Holocaust Memorial Day, when he'd say, the State of Israel wasn't founded because of the Holocaust. That was so meaningful, because because there were so many there was so many infrastructure prepared on the ground decades before the Holocaust. Zionism, the goal to return to Zion, is part of the is part of Jewish liturgy and Jewish theology, and so what David Grossman does, and what what other composers were doing after him, was to think about the Holocaust either separately from Zionism, or while realizing that the Holocaust cannot be discussed or portrayed in any manner under the auspices of Zionism.
Well, that is a full and important explanation, because the Holocaust has been, of course, used by both friends and enemies of Zionism, and dissociating it seems like the right thing to do. Unfortunately, Israel has also had to fight many wars to defend its existence. Talk about the musical impact of any one of Israel's wars.
Okay, here I must say I was very against doing that, because I was very much against this notion of, we have a war, let's examine its aftermath in music. That's what some of my colleagues and predecessors in the field had been doing. And I objected to that, because it's like we're looking for representations to justify the way we talk about cultural history and to justify those themes that people are talking about. And why is it a problem for me? Let's take those big watersheds, 48, 67, 73, 82. Okay, you'd think that after every war, we would get a piece that reflects this war in any kind of expression that would have direct relation to it. Let's take 1948. The problem with this is that it becomes some sort of an optical illusion, because cultural history has a different dialectical rhythm. And if composers arrived in British Palestine in the 30s and 40s, they obviously imported with them various modernist brands through which they were writing music. Now there's a war, and they have to write, if they wish to, not all of them did that, they have to somehow represent or represent it or reflect upon that and so forth. So at best, the war can become a catalyst to write a piece, but the way the piece is written precedes this political event. In other words, I don't want to punctuate or subjugate my cultural history to political and military history. So, and I'm going to say something very alarming, 48 has no meaning in terms of culture. It's a catalyst. Neither 67 nor 82 or 73. It's a catalyst at best, because the tectonic shifts that are taking place in the way composers write music, in their aesthetic decisions, are much more important, whereas the war is at the surface level and could be an excuse or a catalyst to have it as a topic, but underneath it would echo something that preceded this war in, I don't know, decades.
And that would be true for every country, not particular to Israel.
Absolutely.
Finally, Asaf, What are the important trends in today's Israeli art music? Who are the composers to watch?
I haven't written about them because they're really working here and now. First of all, it's super interesting to watch the scene at the moment because you have composers writing music, people who are in their 30s and are just writing their first opuses, and people in their 90s who are probably writing their last opuses. So the sheer simultaneity of composers, it's such a with those age differences and all those in between, many of which got their training, their graduate training abroad. It's so positively noisy and chaotic that we cannot taxonomize it or characterize it in just one sentence. If there is a composer I would talk about, there are actually three. Two women, one man, and this is another positive aspect of that we have many more women in the scene. We had very few in the 40s and 50s, actually. At one point, we only had one. So Betty Olivero is one of them, born in 1954. She got her basic training at the Tel Aviv Music Academy, and after that, she left and studied in the USA and then in Italy, lived almost 20 years abroad. And what's unique about her is that she listens to the space, not the political space, but to this space of the Mediterranean. And she might employ music from Iraq to Morocco, Ladino songs and Yiddish, and she melts it all in this wonderful, in amazing orchestrations and musical formulations that transcend our instinct to explain this music by means of representations or by means of identities. It's just too multivocal and it resists those signifiers, and it's lovely. The other person is Chaya Chernovin, who doesn't live in Israel at the moment, but she also got her training at the Tel Aviv Music Academy. And she is the person who set David Grossman's See Under Love to music as an opera, but not any opera. It's a mute opera. Instead of having, she realized that the text itself of the novel was too dense to lend itself towards a dialogical libretto. And instead, she decided to have the music as broken fragments of noise, probably the result of her attempt to assemble a new language that would cope with the Holocaust, while the singers on stage are actually mimes. It's a mute opera with no libretto, and just broken phonemes heard by four singers in the pit with the orchestra. So she's the second person. And the youngest one is probably Yair Klartag, who was just announced a Siemens Award laureate, a very prestigious prize in Germany. And he writes contemporary avant-garde music where pitch is only one of many, many options when you come to write music. So he embodies this new perception where every sound has equal rights on the musical canvas.
Wow, all three sound remarkable. Extraordinary musicians to watch. Asaf, it's been great talking with you. And before I let you go, tell us a bit about what you're working on now.
Well, I'm actually working on, having realized that the territory had been such a constituent part of Hebrew culture, and having written two books on the topic, I also realized, and that's what happens when you finish a book, you realize what you could have written. Maybe in the next chapter, but I had to stop because I almost reached page 500. I realized that the territory does no longer play a part in what we used to call Hebrew culture, and some of the constituent paradigms that condition the entire scene have been muted by composers. They're not conditioning their work anymore. So I realized that having separated culture from the territory, or when composers had done that, and are currently doing that, when they write music, we might be, in a sense, in a state of afterness. And so I'm writing a book that will probably be titled After Hebrew Culture.
Well, that sounds very interesting. Lots of good luck with that project.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Asaf, for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov. Bye-bye.